ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Debbie Elliott. This hour, ICE raids spark protests in Los Angeles. Why there's turmoil at FEMA just as hurricane season opens.
That's what emergency management has always been and should continue to be, which is nonpartisan, right? Hurricanes, tornadoes, they don't just hit Republicans or Democrats, they hit communities.
Also, a new novel from Taylor Jenkins Reid explores the first women in space.
The spacesuits were made for a male body. The parachutes during water survival training, the harnesses, all of them are made for a male body.
Plus, we dance the flamenco in New Mexico.
Uno, dos, radio heel.
First, the newscast. It's Saturday, June 7th, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. Kilmar Abrego-Garcia is back on U.S. soil. For months, the Trump administration has said it could not bring him back from El Salvador after he was swept up in an immigration raid and sent there by mistake. He's now in Nashville, Tennessee, where he faces federal criminal charges. NPR's Jimena Bustillo has more.
Attorney General Pam Bondi announced in a press conference yesterday that a grand jury in Tennessee had charged Abrego-Garcia of federal crimes. The indictment has one count of alien smuggling and one count of conspiracy to commit alien smuggling. She said that the grand jury found that over the past 9 years, Abrego-Garcia played a significant role in an alien smuggling ring. The indictment alleges that he made over 100 trips transporting people without legal status between Texas and Maryland and other states. NPR has not independently confirmed the smuggling accusations.
NPR's Jimena Bustillo. The Supreme Court has again handed the Trump administration a temporary victory. By a 6-3 vote, the court overturned two lower court orders, allowing DOGE, at least for now, to have unfettered access to information collected by the Social Security Administration. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The court, in an unsigned order, temporarily overturned actions by two lower courts that had limited DOJ's access to sensitive private information, including Social Security numbers, medical and mental health records, and family court records. The court's conservative supermajority sent the case back to the Federal Court of Appeals in Richmond for a ruling on the merits of the case, which likely will take months, while DOJ digs into the records. Justice Kagan noted her dissent, while the court's other two liberals accused the majority of having, quote, truly lost its moorings. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Russia struck Ukraine's second-largest city, Kharkiv, in what the city's mayor says was the largest attack since the full-scale Russian invasion began. At least three people were killed. NPR's Joanna Kakissis reports from Kyiv.
The attack on Kharkiv comes a night after Russia launched a wide-ranging aerial assault targeting nearly all of Ukraine. Kharkiv is in northeastern Ukraine, about 20 miles from the Russian border. Overnight on Saturday, the city was rocked by at least 40 explosions, said Mayor Ihor Tedekhov, writing on Telegram. He called it the most powerful attack since the full-scale invasion and said Russia used missiles, drones, and guided aerial bombs. Ceasefire talks between Russia and Ukraine have made little progress. Russia has increased attacks on Ukrainian cities, often hitting civilians, while Ukraine has destroyed bomber planes and military infrastructure, targeting Russia's war machine. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
This is NPR News in Washington. Israel said today it has retrieved the body of a Thai citizen kidnapped during the attack on Israel on October 7, 2023. The man had come to Israel to work in agriculture. The Israeli military says he was taken to Gaza, where he was killed by his captors. His body was recovered in the area of Rafah in southern Gaza. Starting this week, and for the first time ever, Russians are able to watch the corruption investigation videos of banned, now deceased, Kremlin opponent Alexei Navalny on TV. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports.
Hello. Thank you so much for coming. Yulia Navalnaya, the widow of Alexei Navalny, helped launch the new channel called Russia's Future, which will be beamed in by French satellite Eutelsat. Project director Jim Filipov says Navalny used YouTube because television was always controlled by the Kremlin.
For more than 20 years, the Russian public has been bombarded with anti-Western, anti-Ukrainian, anti-democratic, pro-authoritarian propaganda.
Now, he says, the Navalny team will reach a bigger audience on TV, and unlike with YouTube, the Kremlin will not be able to block the satellite. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
French President Emmanuel Macron is to visit Greenland next weekend to meet with the Prime Minister of the Danish territory and the Danish Prime Minister. The three leaders are expected to discuss security concerns as well as economic development and climate change. The meeting is also designed as an expression of solidarity in light of President Trump's interest in taking over Greenland. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Debbie Elliott, filling in for Scott Simon. Immigration enforcement agents conducted multiple raids throughout Los Angeles yesterday. Those raids sparked protests, with some demonstrators trying to block the transport of detained immigrants. At one point, authorities used pepper spray and flashbang grenades to disperse the crowds. Steve Futterman joins us this morning from Los Angeles with the latest. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Debbie.
So what can you tell us about the raids?
Well, there have been some ICE arrests and detainments in the L.A. area since the start of the Trump administration in January, but this was the largest and most widespread effort. It involved dozens of ICE agents with weapons and armored vehicles. They focused on several areas where they believed they were likely to find a large number of migrants in the country illegally. Among the targets, L.A.'s large downtown garment district, where they focused on a number of warehouses and mom-and-pop shops. Other locations that the ICE agents went after included a downtown Home Depot where many day laborers gather looking for work. Now, as the raids took place, many people who work in those areas actually confronted the ICE agents. They were yelling and screaming. Here you can hear them chanting, "Free them all." Now, some tried to actually block the ICE vehicles, of course, without any success. People threw all sorts of things at the vehicles.
What are you hearing from the protesters?
Well, to put it mildly, there's lots of anger. Israel Gatoy was there. A friend of his was one of those detained. He said there was no need to arrest his friend, that his friend posed no danger.
I work with him. Yes, I work with him. He's no criminal, no nothing. He's nice people. He's working good and nice people. Family, he have two children. Yeah, working every day.
And this was pretty much the feeling of most people there. Now, Debbie, there has been widespread anticipation for several months, as we said earlier, about some possible large effort by ICE. And although there have been some arrests here and there, as we mentioned, there had been nothing on this scale until yesterday. Los Angeles obviously has a large migrant population, which has made it an obvious potential target. We know that at least 44 people were detained yesterday. Many people, though, were left in the dark, unsure if their friends or relatives had been detained. Ileana Johansson Mendez was working with some of those people yesterday.
So there are families waiting to see their family members that were detained earlier today. They have not been able to see their family members.
So in addition to the anger, Debbie, many people were simply unsure overnight as to who actually had been detained.
Now, you talked about how some of the protesters had tried to stop agents from transporting detained migrants. What happened next?
Well, in the late afternoon, as word spread quickly through social media about the raids, people showed up. Around hundreds of people showed up in the downtown area. There was a large rally held near the federal detention center. We heard lots of speeches. But after the rally broke up, the anger turned into some violence. Rocks and bottles, some concrete blocks, trash cans were thrown, even some spray painting on the detention center building. There were some confrontations. We saw some people detained, but there's been no official word about any actual arrests.
So what has been the reaction from the federal government?
Well, it's worth noting that yesterday's raids in Los Angeles are clearly part of a sharp escalation in immigration detention efforts nationwide. Elsewhere on Weekend Edition, you'll hear about the efforts to deploy 20,000 National Guard troops to help accelerate and expand these detentions. There was a telling exchange yesterday on social media between L.A. Mayor Karen Bass and White House Deputy Chief of Staff Stephen Miller. The mayor deplored the raids and said, "We will not stand for this. I am deeply angered. It will not stand." Stephen Miller responded, "You have no say in this at all. Federal law is supreme." And that's pretty much what was the exchange between the two. Today, we're not sure. There could be more raids. It's just not clear, Debbie.
Okay. Well, thank you for your reporting. Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
Thanks, Debbie.
NASA's James Webb Space Telescope has detected a cosmic miracle, according to researchers.
It's basically one of the first galaxies we're possibly ever able to see, which makes it such a remarkable achievement.
Later today on All Things Considered, the most distant galaxy ever captured by the telescope. Catch the conversation live on the radio or tell your smart speaker to play your local station by name. The agency charged with helping the nation prepare for natural disasters is itself in turmoil. President Trump wants the Federal Emergency Management Agency to be slimmed down or done away with entirely. The agency has lost a third of its total staff and sharply reduced emergency training just as hurricane season gets started. It's predicted to be more active than normal this year, with as many as five major hurricanes ahead. Democratic Congressman Jared Moskowitz of Florida, a former emergency manager himself, has been vocal with his concerns about the agency and joins us now to talk about what's going on. Congressman, thanks so much for being on the show.
Hey, Debbie. Thanks for having me.
So with thousands of staffers now gone, senior leadership making for the exits, do you think FEMA's ready to handle the next disaster?
Well, it doesn't appear so. And that's what the memos from the department are saying. And so, listen, let's go backwards for a second. The president was correct that FEMA needed reform. This has not been a secret in the emergency management industry. We've been saying FEMA needed reform for a long period of time. One of those reforms is to get FEMA out of Homeland. Homeland's been disabusing FEMA for years now, making them do all the grants for the other 22 agencies within Homeland, which is a big bureaucratic mess. You know, it's been taking FEMA's focus away from response and recovery, which is their core mission.
I want to talk a little bit more about the new administrator. He's acting chief, David Richardson. You know, earlier this week, he joked with his staff that he wasn't aware we had a hurricane season. And he seems to have gone back and forth on this year's disaster response plan. What are you hearing about the culture and the sentiment among the people who remain at FEMA?
People are very concerned about what's going on there. I mean, they fired the other guy, the previous interim administrator, because he said something truthful, which is that the country and the president would be well served by keeping FEMA. You know, look, I don't know Mr. Richardson. He might be a nice guy, but he's got zero experience with this. It reminds me of the Michael Brown situation.
During Hurricane Katrina 20 years ago.
That's right. So maybe we get lucky, and I hope we do. I hope we, even though they're calling for above average hurricane season, maybe we get lucky. Maybe we don't have a catastrophic event. But if we do, you know, Mr. Richardson is definitely not ready, nor will he know how to respond just to his lack of experience. If I were him, I would be using every day right now in what we call blue skies before we get to gray skies. Try to fix some of these problems that they've created.
Now let's talk about the long-standing problems at FEMA, something that you've talked about in the past, and the criticism indeed has been bipartisan. The Trump administration says FEMA is bloated and has failed Americans. What reforms does the agency need, in your mind?
Well, one, I would get out of Homeland Security. I have a bipartisan bill with Byron Donalds to get FEMA out of Homeland Security. We have a companion bill in the Senate to do the same, make it its own independent agency as it was before 9/11, direct report to the president. Another bill I have, also bipartisan, is to create block grants, right? If we want to streamline some of the grant writing, we could give governors the ability to request block grants so they would be running the grant from their state rather than up here in Washington. Not all states can do that, which is why I wouldn't mandate it. I would allow governors to request it. I would allow the president to approve it, and we could block grant some of that money down.
Now, Congressman, what I'm hearing you say is very similar to what Donald Trump has talked about and what Governor Ron DeSantis has said, that if you cut out the federal bureaucracy and left it to the states, you'd save money. So you're sort of suggesting the states are better positioned to handle this, they just need more federal money to do it?
Well, not all states are created equal, right? And so what I'm saying is there are some states that could handle block granting the money down. The government block grants all sorts of programs down to the states. So this is not a new concept. And so, look, it's not just about bureaucracy up here. It's about getting FEMA to refocus on response and recovery. That's what we need them to do. But we got to stop talking about deleting FEMA, eliminating FEMA. It's not going to happen, and it wouldn't be in the best interest of the American people or red states. Red states would suffer more than anybody else.
You actually ran Florida's emergency management agency for a time, right?
Yeah, I was the director of emergency management for Ron DeSantis. So obviously, you know, not my political party, didn't vote for the governor, but he gave me an opportunity. I took it and I served the residents of Florida. And that's what emergency management has always been and should continue to be, which is nonpartisan, right? Hurricanes, tornadoes, they don't just hit Republicans or Democrats, they hit communities.
So your district in South Florida is one of the more hurricane-prone parts of the country. Are you telling your constituents to be preparing for hurricane season any differently, given the upheaval at FEMA?
I am. In fact, we literally just sent out a newsletter to my constituents. And what I've said to them specifically this year, different, is be prepared for things to be slower. Don't wait till the last minute. Go out and get some of these things beforehand. You can get bottled water. You can get batteries early. Make sure you have them, right? You can get canned goods early. You don't have to wait. So I want people to understand, you know, that that's where we're at.
That's U.S. Representative Jared Moskowitz, Democrat from Florida. Congressman, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Russia attacked the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv overnight with high-precision, long-range missiles and drones. Ukrainian officials say at least 3 people were killed and at least 21 others were wounded. Another 1,000 people were forced from their homes in the Canadian province of Manitoba yesterday as a wildfire approaches. They join thousands of Canadians already under evacuation orders. And in Los Angeles, police use tear gas and flashbangs to disperse protesters outside a federal detention center last night. They were protesting immigration raids across the city this week, in which dozens were arrested. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Debbie Elliott. And now it's time for sports. More than a century of amateur play in college is over. But the French Open women's final is happening right now. Throw in a thrilling Stanley Cup and a surprising NBA finals, and you have a lot to talk about with ESPN's Michelle Steele. She joins me now. Good morning, Michelle.
Good morning, Deb.
So last night, a federal judge signed off on a $2.8 billion settlement, which now paves the way for colleges to pay athletes directly. This is a remarkable moment, ending more than a century of the amateur model in college sports. What's that going to look like?
Well, lots of lawsuits have led to this, Deb. It's been a long time coming. So what'll happen is that starting as early as July, schools can pay athletes around $20 million total each year. It's a revenue sharing deal is what they're calling it. Football and basketball are the biggest revenue generators, so those players are going to be the biggest beneficiaries. Now, NIL still going to be around, just more regulated, but boy, are we a far cry from athletes playing for school pride and a scholarship.
Or a $100 handshake, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's go now to the French Open. The women's final is underway. Number one, Aryna Sabalenka of Belarus, is playing number two, Coco Gauff from the U.S. Gauff could become the first American to win a women's single title in Paris in a decade. How's she doing?
Yeah, so far she's battling. Sabalenka, I should say, did win the opening set, but it was an epic fashion. It lasted 77 minutes. She was up 4-1 very early, but Coco Gauff fought her way back. Sabalenka did end up prevailing 7-6 in a first set tiebreak, and currently Coco is leading in the second set. It's 5-2 right now, and Coco Gauff is currently serving, so she's got a shot here.
On the ice, the Stanley Cup now tied after two games. The defending champs, the Florida Panthers, even things up with a double overtime win over the Edmonton Oilers. Has this cup final rematch from last year been everything you've expected?
This was exactly the finals that I wanted. I wanted revenge to be a factor here for this series. And it is. Connor McDavid looks like he's on a mission, but the series is even right now. The Panthers, though, they have a new star, Brad Marchand, who came from the Bruins. And he's got, Deb, my favorite nickname in hockey, Nose Face Killa. He had the double OT winner last night, and I hope the series goes 7 games.
Okay, and now for the Ballers. The Indiana Pacers are the surprise leaders, up 1 over Oklahoma City Thunder after the first game of the NBA Finals, thanks to yet another buzzer beater by Tyrese Halliburton. That makes 4 stunning late-game comebacks for the Pacers in these playoffs. At some point, I guess we quit calling that stunning, right?
Yeah.
The Pacers were the underdogs headed to Oklahoma City for that game. Were we wrong?
Yes, we were all wrong, you know, but we weren't the only ones. Even the experts doubted the Pacers because they don't have a star-studded roster. They don't have top 5 MVP candidates up and down this roster. But they're not a fluke anymore. Tyrese Halliburton is absolutely him. hitting a game winner in every round of the playoffs this
year. He's so fun to watch.
He is so fun. The most clutch player in the NBA right now. He is absolutely a star, and one of his best friends is also a star, Caitlin Clark, of course, who plays for the Indiana Fever.
Nice. Finally, pro softball's here. The Athletes United Softball League opening day is today. It's a modest start with just four teams, but as you've been reporting, there's a lot of support for this new league, right?
You know what? The organizers took a look around. They looked at the college softball landscape, and it is on fire right now, Deb. The ratings are through the roof. Last year's 2024 Women's College World Series actually reached a new record level, 2 million people tuning in for that series. That's a very good number.
I watched the championship last night. It was very good.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Texas Tech. Absolutely. And it's making people think that pro softball has got a real chance to succeed. Women's sports are surging right now, and they're making a big push with this new league. They got a big investment from Major League Baseball. They have a star commissioner in Kim Ng. She was a long-term MLB executive. They've got a TV deal with ESPN and regional sports networks. They start play this weekend, a couple months, barnstorming 10 cities all around the country, including, by the way, Tuscaloosa. I know you're in Alabama.
Roll Tide.
And it should be a lot of fun.
That's ESPN's Michelle Steele. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Elon Musk may be done as a special government employee, but many of the billionaire's businesses still have massive federal contracts. Contracts that could be in jeopardy after this week's nasty falling out with President Trump. NPR's Stephen Fowler joins us now to help unpack the complicated relationship. Complicated to say the least. Hey, Stephen.
Good morning.
So when President Trump and Musk were lobbing attacks back and forth Thursday on social media, both of them mentioned the possibility of canceling these contracts. When it comes to Musk's businesses, just how big of a customer is the federal government?
So the main company we're talking about here is SpaceX. It's got big contracts with NASA for things, including the Dragon capsule. That's what astronauts use to get to and from the International Space Station. Tesla, Musk's auto company, made it through tough financial times early on thanks to low interest loans from the Energy Department. It's earned billions of dollars in regulatory credits for the electric vehicle industry. SpaceX's Starlink satellite network has become a key part of the government's expansion of internet access across the country. And there's a ton of military and intelligence spending we don't know the full scope of because it's classified. But Debbie, in all, Musk's businesses have received tens of billions of dollars in public support that we know about from those things like contracts and low interest loans and tax breaks.
So what would be some of the ramifications if either side does dial back on this partnership?
Well, in the middle of that social media spat on Thursday, Trump threatened to end Musk's contracts. Musk threatened to decommission the Dragon capsule, but either one of those actions would seriously cripple both Musk's companies and the federal government. I mean, the government subsidy piece is a big part of Musk's wealth that in turn allowed him to buy social media site X and donate about $250 million to help send Trump to the Oval Office last year. So cutting that off would be a huge blow to Musk's financial empire and future influence, even though he says he's not really doing that much anymore. But also, Musk's companies are playing crucial roles in parts of how the government functions. Case in point, our colleague Jeff Brumfield has pointed out more than 80% of everything that went into space last year did it aboard a SpaceX rocket.
Now, is it possible that Trump and Musk bury the hatchet to keep things running smoothly?
After the fireworks online Thursday, it's largely been all quiet on the social media front since then. I mean, Trump has done a number of phone interviews saying that he's basically moving on from Musk and has no plans to talk to him anytime soon. Musk has largely kept things quiet too, posting about his companies and how great they are, which is a more pressing concern for him, seeing as how Tesla stock prices have dropped this year. mainly because of Musk's role in federal government. That was with DOGE, the Department of Government Efficiency cost-cutting effort that has led to a lot of chaos within the government and a lot of backlash to Musk the businessman. And President Trump told reporters on Air Force One yesterday that, quote, we'll take a look at everything when it comes to the contracts, and he didn't have any plans to smooth things over. Trump also added that he's occupied with other, quote, problems in faraway lands.
I mean, certainly both the president and Elon Musk have more important things to attend to. But I'd like us to back up a little bit. What was the root of this blow up?
Well, there are definitely larger concerns when you talk about the genesis of this fight. Trump's one big beautiful bill, chock full of his agenda items, including tax cuts and including increased deficit spending, it's facing challenges from Republicans in both chambers that express skepticism about different parts of it. The increase in deficit spending in particular is a hang-up, and that's even before Elon Musk started posting about this. While Musk has seen his way out of Trump's inner circle over the last few weeks, he still does have a lot of sway with the online discourse about politics, thanks to his social media site, X.
That's NPR's Stephen Fowler. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C., just down the street from the White House, is closed to traffic today for a parade, the World Pride Parade. Many thousands of people are expected this afternoon, gay, transgender, queer, young, old, all races and religions, and this year especially, people from all over the world. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin joins us now for a preview. Hi there, Selena.
Hi, Debbie.
So D.C. is usually pretty lit up for Pride every June, but this year it seems to be a different level. Why is that?
Yeah, so this year, World Pride is being celebrated here in the district. That is a roving international version of the Pride parades that happen all over the place in the summer months. The first one was in 2000 in Rome. It's been in Madrid and Toronto, and this year it's in D.C. Later today is the parade, but it's really a festival that's been going on for several weeks with concerts and sporting events, art shows, lectures, and more.
Tell us what it's like out there in the city. There's a lot going on politically right now with gay and trans people in America.
Yeah, I mean, from its earliest moments, the second Trump administration has passed all sorts of executive orders affecting LGBTQ people. All the anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI efforts have affected them. The White House has declared there are only two sexes and they cannot change. Transgender people cannot compete in sports. There are limits to healthcare access, military service. Here in DC, there is a higher percentage of LGBTQ residents than any state in the country. There is tension between the federal government and the DC government over its local budget. And that tension ratcheted up this week when the National Park Service put tall black fences around DuPont Circle, which is basically the heart of DC's historic gay neighborhood. The given reason was public safety and because of past vandalism during Pride. But after local pushback, the fencing actually came down this morning, just a few hours before the parade is set to start. But certainly that incident highlights some of the tension between the federal government and the city where it is based.
Has that tension affected the feeling in the city leading up to the parade?
I would say yes. There is a sense of nervousness that I don't remember from past years. All of those Trump administration policies we talked about led some places to warn transgender people in particular against traveling to DC from abroad. Here's Zach, who asked NPR only use his first name because he is a federal worker and fears retaliation for criticizing the Trump administration.
Anti-trans and anti-queer policies made a lot of people, especially those in foreign countries, feel like they weren't welcome here.
Now, what about businesses that have traditionally supported the parade?
Yeah, I mean, corporate sponsorships are down, not just when it comes to World Pride in DC, but across the country. Gravity Research did a survey of 200 corporations on their participation in Pride events and found a third were scaling back this year. Some companies are nervous about being called out by President Trump, so they're trying to lay low in terms of public support while reassuring their employees they still care. And that's a difficult needle to thread.
So you've talked about this increased tension. Is that tamping down the parade's sense of celebration?
I mean, we'll see you later this afternoon, but I will say there's a saying you'll hear a lot this year. The first Pride was a riot, and that's a reference to the Stonewall Inn, where transgender people fought back against a police raid in New York City in 1969. So Pride did not start because rainbows are pretty. It started because discriminatory laws and societal intolerance pushed queer people to the breaking point, and they decided to fight back. Mm-hmm. So I think this political moment has LGBTQ people thinking about that history and how fighting back when the odds seem stacked against you is something this community knows how to do.
That's NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Paddlefish have been swimming in North American waters since the time of the dinosaurs. The odd-looking prehistoric fish are a threatened species in several states, including Minnesota, but they seem to be making a comeback. Reporter Hannah Yang with member station Minnesota Public Radio has more.
Paddlefish really do look like they come from a different age. They have no bones, just cartilage, and they can be huge. 5 to 7 feet long, weighing 60 to 80 pounds.
There's no teeth, just a big giant mouth.
That's Anthony Sint of the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, describing the fish's paddle-shaped snout.
The paddle, called the rostrum, it's actually an electrosensory organ that helps them detect zooplankton.
Sint's colleague, Hannah Anima, describes the smooth skin of the fish.
They have like this really cool blue tone to them, and their backs get really dark. And then they actually have, I would almost compare to like leopard spots on their gill covers. And then their fins are really like a purpley mauve color.
Sint and Anima are boating up a stretch of the Minnesota River in the south central part of the state. They stop periodically to drop a hydrophone into the water, which picks up signals from fish tagged with an ultrasonic transmitter. Sint says each transmitter's ping is unique, like a barcode, and lets researchers know which fish they found.
You know, it sounds the same to us no matter what, but this is taking that acoustic signal and turning it into the data. So that was another fish.
Paddlefish started disappearing a little over a century ago due to overfishing, habitat loss, water pollution, and the construction of dams, which limited their migration. But now paddlefish numbers are rising. So Anima and Sint are tracking their movements to get a better idea of how many there are and where they're located. We travel a mile upstream to collect data from a stationary receiver attached to a highway bridge. Anima removes the receiver with a magnet while Sint uploads the data into a laptop.
Any tagged fish or fish with a transmitter implanted in it that swims near this bridge, if it emits the signal while it's somewhat nearby, that will pick it up, save the information of the fish number and the specific time, and then we can upload that data and use that from all the receivers throughout the river to better understand movement patterns of different fish species, such as paddlefish.
It isn't clear yet if paddlefish are spawning more here, migrating from somewhere else, or both. But this stretch of the Minnesota River seems to be a favorite place for them to gather. Sint says improved water quality and the removal of some dams appear to be helping.
We can be hopeful that they will have access to important habitats and potentially help increase their abundance and the health of their population in the whole system. And I know it will do that for other species as well.
The resurgence of the strange-looking underwater behemoth has people taking notice.
This is a wild creature. Not the prettiest creature, but it's a very fascinating creature.
That's Dave Long, co-owner of Paddlefish Brewing Company. The taproom pays homage to its namesake with a scrap metal art sculpture and a wall of photos of people holding paddlefish.
I think it's important as a person living is being in awe and wonder and learning and seeing all the weird, wild things we have right here in St. Peter. These paddlefish are living right under our feet.
And people here see them as a good sign for the health of the region's rivers. For NPR News, I'm Hannah Yang in St. Peter, Minnesota.
This is NPR News.
Two estranged sisters are forced back together following the murder of one of their husbands. But it isn't easy to forget the past.
Oh my God, enough of the Jerry Springer antics. A sick burn, 1998.
Actor Elizabeth Banks talks about her new TV series, The Better Sister. That and the latest in politics, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Kilmer Abrego Garcia is back in the U.S. He was swept up in an immigration raid and sent to El Salvador in March, despite a court order that he not be sent there. He's now in Tennessee, where he faces charges of transporting undocumented immigrants. Immigration raids this week in Los Angeles prompted a protest outside a federal detention center last night. Police used tear gas and flashbangs to break it up. And the Belmont Stakes is today the third leg of horse racing's Triple Crown. It's being held for a second year at Saratoga Racecourse, while Belmont Park is being renovated. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Debbie Elliott. Now for the story of a new star. Jasmine Amy Rogers made her Broadway debut this spring as Betty Boop in the musical Boop. Reporter Jeff London first met her in 2017 when she was a finalist in the National High School Musical Theater Awards, the Jimmys.
As part of the Jimmy Awards, Jasmine Amy Rogers and her fellow nominees were treated to dinner at Sardi's, the Theater District restaurant that features portraits of Broadway actors on the walls. And the 18-year-old was pretty blown away.
It's so, so cool. I mean, seeing all the faces on the wall is just amazing. I mean, that's like what we hope, like one day, like our face is gonna be up there.
As you know, I'm not from here, local legend like some here. Yeah, but now that I've come here, it's where I wanna be.
Now the star of Boop on Broadway and winner of several awards, including the Drama Desk for Outstanding Actor in a Musical, Rogers got her Sardi's portrait. As the cast, crew, and producers of Boop gathered in a room with pictures of Liza Minnelli, Whoopi Goldberg, and Brooke Shields, among others, the portrait was unveiled. And Jasmine Amy Rogers spoke to everyone gathered.
8 years ago, almost exactly, I was here in Sardi's with the Jimmy Awards. I had never been here before, and I was looking at all the pictures, and I was like, oh my gosh, how insane is this? And so the fact that this is happening today is really just like this insane full circle moment.
And Rogers' ascendance from a high school talent to a genuine Broadway star is astonishing, which is something we talked about in the noisy gathering at Sardi's.
I just can't believe that this is all happening. I'm living my dream, and it's going so well. You know, I couldn't have asked for any of this to go better. Oh, my gosh.
Jasmine Amy Rogers now on the wall at Sardi's and up for a Tony Award tomorrow evening. Oh, my gosh, indeed. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
The new novel, Atmosphere, starts in 1984 at the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Joan Goodwin is an astronaut, but her job this day is with Mission Control. She's tasked with being the only person who speaks directly to the crew aboard the Space Shuttle Navigator. Joan is a calm person, which is good, given the crisis that quickly unfolds.
Everyone is up out of their seats. Joan can barely hear herself think. She has been through simulations like this, with the pressure dropping rapidly and no way to stabilize it. They have ended only when the leak is found, or the crew dies. This is NASA. We have a plan for this.
We have a plan for this. I love that line.
Thank you. I think I stole it from NASA. So all compliments go to NASA on that one.
That's author Taylor Jenkins Reid. She didn't just write a gripping story about a space accident. Atmosphere covers the early days of the shuttle program and the challenges faced by the first women astronauts. That includes proving themselves. It also includes self-discovery. High-achieving astronomer Joan Goodwin never thought she'd ever fall in love. When she does, with fellow astronaut Vanessa Ford, the two have to keep their relationship quiet. The stakes get especially high during the crisis 250 miles above the Earth, when Vanessa is the only astronaut aboard the Navigator who can communicate with Mission Control.
They are deploying a satellite when something goes wrong. There are two explosive cords that detonate, and one of them detonates incorrectly and sends shrapnel into the airlock and also somewhere into the cabin. The cabin pressure begins to drop rapidly, which can be very fatal very quickly.
Introduce us to Joan Goodwin. Who is she, and what is her life like before she joins NASA?
Yeah. So Joan Goodwin is an astronomer. She's been in love with the stars since she was a child. And when she hears that women are being accepted into the astronaut corps, she becomes very eager to apply. She actually applies twice before she gets in. And it's only once she gets to the astronaut corps and she is surrounded by this new group of people that she starts to realize she may not understand herself as much as she thought she did.
At one point, Joan says to one of her new colleagues, "I've always felt when I look at the stars, I'm reminded that I'm never alone." What does she find at NASA?
She finds like-minded people. She finds people who understand her in a way that no one else really has before. They're all attempting to do something really exceptional. They're all attempting to leave the atmosphere. And the pull to do that is something that has been in her for a long time, but has always been hard to describe. And so when she meets a group of people who also feel that pull, she feels a kinship that she's never felt before. And she feels that most specifically with Vanessa Ford. Vanessa seems to be able to articulate why she wants to go up there in a way that really captivates Joan.
So the novel takes place, this is the early 1980s. It's toggling back and forth between the space disaster, right? And the years leading up to it as Joan and Vanessa and others are training. They are the second ever astronaut cohort with women in it. What was NASA like for them back then?
You know, I read a lot of books about the space shuttle program. And one of the things that I kept seeing was how NASA, but also the press, had a lot of adjusting to do in allowing women into the astronaut corps. It's not just that a lot of the men had to learn how to work with women. It was also things as simple as the spacesuits were made for a male body. The parachutes during water survival training, the harnesses, all of them are made for a male body. So there were a lot of things that the first few rounds of women entering the astronaut corps had to sort of raise their hand and say, hey, here's where we need things to change. And I'm always curious about that moment for anyone, but for women in general. How do they handle that moment? How do they make the world change in these small incremental ways? It was part of the appeal of writing about NASA for me. I got really curious what it was like to be one of those women in group 8 or group 9.
Now, how did you research all of this? Did you actually go talk to people at NASA in those early days?
You know, the first thing I did was I went to the Johnson Space Center. We actually went into a decommissioned space shuttle, which was really incredible. I watched all the great space movies. I watched Gravity and Apollo 13 and The Right Stuff and all that. But the fact is, the hardest part of this book was getting the mechanics of the space shuttle right and understanding the specifics of mission control. And for that, I needed help. And I'm very fortunate to be able to say that Paul Dye, who is the longest serving flight director at NASA, who served during the space shuttle program and has since retired, he was very generous with his time and really helped to make this book what it is.
That explains how you knew exactly how many latches there were on every hatch.
Yeah. And also, I will say, one of the things that I was surprised to find is that because NASA is a government organization, there is a lot of old PDFs you can find on the internet. So I have papers about the payload bay doors that were written in the 1970s. And, you know, when a sentence just got too convoluted for me to understand without an engineering degree, I called Paul Dye.
Joan is a scientist, but she's also at times sharing her sense of faith. I'm wondering if we can get you to read some of that section of the book. It's this moment where she and Vanessa are talking about religious belief. And Joan says, the pursuit of a unifying theory to explain the universe is science, but it's also the pursuit of God.
This is Joan speaking to Vanessa. I would go so far as to say that as human beings, we are less of a who and more of a when. We are a moment in time when all of our cells have come together in this body. But our atoms were many things before, and they will be many things after. The air I'm breathing is the same air your ancestors breathed. Even what is in my body right now, the cells, the air, the bacteria, it's not only mine. It's a point of connection with every other living thing, made up of the same kinds of particles, ruled by the same physical laws.
Where does this come from? Is this your belief as well?
I'm writing as Joan, but I would be lying if I didn't admit that a lot of Joan has rubbed off on me. When I decided to write about space, I didn't know that I would feel like that necessitated writing about spirituality, but the two feel very linked to me. And I felt like Joan would be prompted in her life to have thought about these things. And I believed she would think of them this way. I'm not putting forth any new ideas, but this is who I believe Joan is. And it's one of my favorite things about her. And it is certainly something that I've taken with me myself.
Taylor Jenkins Reid, her new novel is Atmosphere. Thank you so much for being on the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
New Mexico is known for a lot of things. Green chilies, the world's largest hot air balloon festival, and its stunning desert landscapes. But it's also a global center of flamenco, the passionate dance, song, and music of the Roma people of southern Spain. As our old friend John Burnett reports, the epicenter of flamenco in the United States is Albuquerque.
Later this month, Albuquerque is hosting a world-famous flamenco festival. The University of New Mexico offers the only dance degrees with an emphasis in flamenco, and the National Institute of Flamenco is home to a conservatory and a world-class repertory dance company. An instructor is showing a studio full of kids the classic percussive footwork. The popularity of flamenco has exploded in the last four decades. You can find it from Tokyo to Israel to Toronto, throughout Latin America, in Miami, New York, and San Francisco. What's different about flamenco in Nuevo Mexico is that it's homegrown, which makes sense. New Mexico traces its Hispanic identity to the arrival of Spanish settlers 400 plus years ago.
There's other people who want to do and replicate flamenco exactly the way it's been done in Spain.
Here in New Mexico, it's got to sound like us.
Vicente Griego is a celebrated flamenco singer from northern New Mexico.
But what makes us really special here and what keeps us honest is that we have our own history. We've had our own celebration and liberation.
That's Griego singing the deep song of flamenco with Hijastros, the American Flamenco Repertory Company. It's part of the National Institute of Flamenco, founded 43 years ago by Eva Encinas, the Grand Dame of Flamenco in Albuquerque.
Even though we present all of this very, very high-end flamenco, the rationale behind that is to inspire and cultivate young people.
Outreach is a huge part of their mission. Between Eva and her children, Joaquin and Marisol, they've taught thousands of flamenco students at the Institute and at UNM.
We all started as children, and we know the impact that flamenco had on us as young people.
To that end, the Institute sends teachers into New Mexico public schools.
And so we're going to clap along to the music. The music is in 4-4 time, which means that we count 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4.
Sarah Ward, a Canadian who became enthralled with flamenco and now teaches it, is leading a class of fourth graders at the Taos Integrated School of the Arts. 15 kids stomp their sneakers to the count.
And then we had another rhythm. 2 and 3, 4. 2 and 3, 4. Yeah.
Ward says New Mexico is the best place to learn flamenco outside of Spain.
It has such a rich cultural heritage here. We have grown it in the earth here as well, and so it's very much part of the New Mexican experience.
One of the bright-eyed students is Cyprus Musialowski, 10 years old. The interviewer is journalist Monica Ortiz Uribe.
I feel an opportunity to let out anger. I really like stomping my feet, but I also feel like I can just flow and be me.
Yeah. What does it feel like when you're dancing and you release that anger?
It feels great. I love it. Because in class, I can't just stomp my feet around because I'll get in trouble.
Flamenco has been called performed aggression. The pounding wooden heels, the feral singing, the Baroque guitar work. The Spanish poet Federico Garcia Lorca defined duende, the spirit of flamenco, as tragedy-inspired ecstasy.
I think what really distinguishes flamenco is the grittiness of it.
Evelyn Mendoza is the 27-year-old education manager at the Flamenco Institute. While she has a degree in contemporary dance from UNM, it was flamenco that captured her soul.
I mean, you sweat your heart, soul, tears, blood, and everything into any dance form that you do, but flamenco is so different because it's fierce.
The fierceness, poetry, and passion of flamenco will be celebrated at Festival Flamenco Albuquerque, June 20 to 28. This year, 14 of the world's best flamenco companies will perform in Albuquerque at what's called the most celebrated flamenco festival outside of Spain. Naturally, it's in New Mexico. For NPR News, I'm John Burnett in Albuquerque.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Debbie Elliott.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you.
Rascal, you.
I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you.
Rascal, you.
When you're dead and 6 feet deep, no more chicken will you eat or you dog. You rascal, you.
Rascal, you.
I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. I'll be glad when you did, you rascal, you. I took you into my home, you wouldn't leave my wife alone, or your dog.